Good afternoon. I need to, great pleasure to be here. It's a great honor to bring Will. And following up on Mel's comments on veterans and people of service, I will point out that Will is one of those people who has spent most of his professional career keeping us safe while he was at the NSA. Most of you know it's a national security agency, probably the most secretive part of our government. I had the great pleasure of watching Will grow up, knowing, being great friends of his family, and very early on in life, we knew that Will was on a different path. Rather than being out playing football, baseball, etc., Will was busy rewiring his parents' house at 7 years old. I think he built his first computer at eight, and he was totally proficient in basic software by maybe eight and a half. However, even though a whiz kid, Will did not excel at school. Later we found out it was too boring for him, but he ended up attending a fascinating place called Rose-Hulman, which is a technology engineering school out in Terre Haute, Indiana. Many of you have heard of it. From there, Will was recruited to go into the NSA and take his many, many skills to help serve our government. While there, and I should say that while there, Will was involved in tracking down terrorists in Iraq. He even was backing up a lot of our special ops. He went to Iraq and is given credit for tracking down a bomber and a whole bomber network that helped with our special ops teams. I don't know if he'll talk about that, but because he's modest, but he has been of great service. Will, while at NSA, developed a new, a new protocol for protecting data and making firewalls that we have used historically obsolete. And he called this TDF, Trusted Data Format. Today, and Will went on to form his own company, which you may mention, and TDF is a state-of-the-art security system out there. Any of you that use Gmail, it's protected by TDF. Some of his clients are the biggest financial institutions in the country. And most recently, Will was featured in Fortune's 40 Under 40, People Are Changing the World. If Hillary Clinton had used TDF, I won't finish the sentence. But I will bring up Will Ackerley. And it's a great honor to have him here. And Will, it's all yours.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Webb, thank you for the great introduction. It's really a pleasure to be here and an honor. So thank you very much. Given the recent email hacks, I would be very remiss in not, given my security background, in not addressing these email hacks, what we can do about it today, and what exactly happens today in terms of when you send an email. Why does it go so many places? Where does it end up? Who will see it? Who will copy it? Who will steal it? And where and when might it surface? A lot of the issues with email really have to do with the history and the outdated models and the false assumptions that we made coming up with it in its inception. So a little bit of background, Webb alluded to this. I spent 8 years at NSA trying to build technologies to protect our government's data. Started with high-speed network encryption, trying to connect different facilities and make sure that as data was being transported between those facilities, it was well protected. As I deployed, I got a sense of how this can work and how it sometimes does not work, how these false assumptions, not just email, but also how we're doing things with the government, can interfere with our ability to share. To get specific, right, so a lot of the way we built our security systems was assuming that we had a security perimeter, right? That the people and the data and the assets that we have, we could put inside, and then we could protect that perimeter. It turns out that interferes with the way we actually do business, right? Those perimeters are going to get in the way of our ability to collaborate with people externally, whether that's, you know, commercially with business partners or in the government with coalition partners. So when I was in Iraq, I faced this head on, right? So what we were doing is we were building different networks to protect different kinds of data. We'd have a top secret network for the top secret data. We'd have a secret network for the secret data. We would have a coalition network for one kind of coalition and another coalition network for another coalition. These were all physically in different facilities. And we were told, okay, the way that you get information is you pick up the phone, you call an analyst, and you hope they're there to answer your question. I had clearance to go to these places, but I could never go to one place and get the information that I needed. So what ended up happening is I was hoofing it from facility to facility trying to get the information to help the folks on my team. So what ended up happening at scale, actually, in Iraq, was we ended up failing open. You know, too often, the systems that we had in place were getting in the way of mission. So what leadership said was, look, we can't say no. We have to fail open, right? If your encrypted radio doesn't work, then you go in the clear, right? Because it's more dangerous not to have the data and the information that you need to conduct your mission. So turn to Private Bradley Manning. He was out in Iraq while I was there as well. And what this failed open system meant is that he could, even though he had no need to know, copy hundreds of thousands of cables and emails, right, to a CD that he labeled Lady Gaga. It was not Lady Gaga. And this was the first big WikiLeaks email scandal. There are two failed assumptions here, right? So one is we can keep bad actors from being inside the perimeter. The other is that good actors can get their job done and keep while we're keeping information within those perimeters. So take a step back, look at what's happening more broadly, right? So in terms of email hacks, it's not just the recent DNC email hacks. This also happened to Sony. There's reason to believe that that might be on account of the North Koreans. And anecdotally, right, so the Snapchat CEO, even though he was on a different email system, because he sent an email out to Sony, it was vulnerable there as well. So for email in particular, why is it so easy to get compromised? Why after sending that email would there be so many copies, and why is it so easy to get lost and get compromised? So, because clearly, right, the assumption would be for a technologically advanced, electronic email would be superior in every way to normal email, or normal mail for that matter. Physical mail has some interesting security properties you might think would be, you know, available within email, right? You have an envelope, you can put a letter in, you can seal it up. There's some tamper evidence associated with that. And there's a single copy, right? So your mailman doesn't inherently get a copy of your mail after he's delivered it. You can look at it, you can open it up, and you've got a relative amount of confidence that you've got the only copy. If you shred it, you're in good shape. What actually happens to email today is not that at all. It's more like a postcard, right? And anyone who is responsible for mediating that transfer from the sender to the recipient gets a copy. It was designed in a way that you store a copy of the email every single place it goes, right? So everyone handling it can see it. And encryption, you might think, oh, well, Gmail encrypts my email. I see this little green lock in my browser. But that actually just protects the link between you and your electronic postman. He still gets a copy. He can still read your email, and that's how a lot of these businesses are built, in terms of being able to read your email, understand you as a person, and be able to more effectively sell your advertising. So if we take a step back in the history of physical mail, we actually have some really interesting precedents, some things we can look back to as things we can potentially try to bring back to electronic mail. Even in the ancient Roman times, they actually had a very sophisticated way of protecting and authenticating mail. And it was something called a seal box. And you could wrap up your message in a little metal box. It had your institution's seal on top of it. You'd put your personal seal inside with like a wax seal, close it up, and that's how you could make sure that when the recipient got it, if that seal was intact, no one read it in between. It was the only copy, and they knew it came from you. And these, you know, littered across the empire. And if you want one, you can go to eBay and grab one. They're pretty cool. So even, you know, when during the founding of our country, right? So George Washington used a wax and a seal, a signet on a ring you carried around with you. Benjamin Franklin, he used three when he was talking to France. So like triple security, right? And that you know, persisted, right? So ephemeral access, you know, on a ship, delivered, no copies, tamper evidence, right? And in fact, additional to that, there are strong legal protections and serious legal penalties associated, as you know, it's a felony to interfere with post office mail. So what about email, right? So why are we less secure? It's because when the internet was invented, security was not a concern, not really. And there's also a tradition, essentially, of punting, right? Layering concerns and solving one problem and then addressing another. Some security concerns have been addressed, but it's still early in its evolution. So there's a lot of work still to be done. And just a little bit of background. So in terms of the internet, it actually started as a group mostly of government-funded institutions building networks, trying to connect computers in the 60s to try to answer very specific problems. But what ended up happening is those networks couldn't talk to each other. So Vint Cerf in 1973 and a few of his colleagues said, well, what are we going to do about this? Said, okay, well, we're not going to worry about the specifics of whether or not ARPA and defense research, what they're doing, or the National Science Foundation and their labs, what they're doing. We're going to build something underneath, not a network protocol, but an inter-network protocol. So in 1973, the internet was invented, and it set as a precedent separation of concerns, right? So let's just worry about connecting people, but not worry about the security. And since then, we've been trying to identify those security issues and address them one by one. But we still have made attempts and failed so far to apply that kind of security and upgrade the level of security of email. The attempts so far have been heavily manual, and if any of you have ever tried PGP, it's very esoteric, very, very hard to use. So we do need a new layer on top to improve this. So how have people been reacting in the presence of not very secure email today so far? Some people keep sending insecure email with sensitive data. Some people have resolved that self-censorship is more of the answer, right? So the instinct of, hey, don't put that in an email, call me, right? Or walk down the hall. You don't want to put that in an email, right? That's a symptom of the system being fundamentally broken. And then also internationally, right? So after Snowden leaks, Deutsche Telekom said, you know what? We're going to build our own internet, right? We're going to build our own isolated network, and that's how we're going to solve the problem. Because no one in Germany needs to be able to communicate with people externally, right? So that, as we all know, that inevitably failed. From a legal standpoint, right? So Europe has also been pushing something called the General Data Protection Regulation. Now that got passed in April. It's not in effect yet. It'll be in effect in May of 2018. But what it does is it says, look, if people don't have an inherent ability to consent to how their data is used, we are going to pass that in a law. We're going to say that in May of 2018, we're just going to mandate that individuals have to consent to companies using their data a particular way. They're going to have to declare the purpose of that, and they're going to have the right to erase. So then the question is, well, how can you have confidence that a company who has to comply with this is actually erasing your data? So there's still an element of trust in trusting someone who you might not want to have to trust. There's also an evolution happening here. There's something called the Email Privacy Act in the United States, trying to catch up with some of the laws and regressions and saying that you actually have to get a warrant to get access to one of these copies that are floating out there. But do we have to rely on the law? Do we have to rely on trusting others? The answer is no. There are things that we can do to protect ourselves and to protect our data. So if you're thinking, okay, well, what can I do now? One thing you can do is protect your identity in addition to data. And that's straightforward. You can do that today. Make sure you don't share passwords, and you know, some email systems allow you to send a code to your phone. If you do that, that's a really good step. Now, you still have to trust your internet provider today. So what do we do about protecting data? So there is a new approach, and Webb alluded to this a little bit earlier, and it really worked well for the intelligence community. And that is, ensure that data is protected before you send it, in a way where it doesn't matter where your data goes, right? And we don't need to change the way we operate or ditch your email address. It can be automatic, and it can be as subtle as the green lock that you have in your browser window. In building upon the tradition of the layers of the internet, this is a new layer, right? So we can add this on top of exactly what we're doing today. We don't have to throw everything away. And the key, right, is in the self-protecting data, so that that protection travels wherever that data goes. So the idea here is you hold on to keys, right? So you can wrap your data, let it go anywhere, but you can't unlock it because you have a key ring, right? So if you can defer and control and have insight, right, you don't have to trust those intermediaries. What that means is you don't have to trust your network provider. You don't have to trust your phone provider, your cloud provider. But if you want to, you can trust recipients, right? But you can also say, hey, I don't want to give you the key anymore because that transaction's over. You can delete the key and make that data go away. So you don't have to worry about everything that you're creating online creating this trail that lasts forever and ever. So does this kind of control, does this approach of the ability to encrypt any message and create a key where you have insight and control inhibit sharing, is that antisocial, right? In fact, it's a bit of a sharing paradox, right? The more control you give someone, the more they will share, right? The ability to defer whether or not you're going to want that deleted in the future. You make that ad hoc decision is really helped. And in the intelligence community, in particular, when you're talking about different networks, and when you've got data on one network and you're trying to transfer it to another, you have no idea what the environment there might be like. Giving the originator, the person who you want to collaborate with, the choice to say, this is how I want my data used, I might change my mind later, and have insight and control can be very powerful. We started answering questions that we couldn't answer before. Data could get into the hands of people who couldn't get it before because of the concerns and the risk that they would lose control. This did become personal for me when it came time. I went to a doctor. There was a suggestion they get my DNA sequenced, right? So being who I am, I asked the questions of, okay, well, how is my data going to get used? Where is it going to get stored, et cetera? And they said, oh no, it's going to be protected, it's going to be anonymized, but you can't anonymize genetic data. If my brother got his genetic sequence and I'm the only other sibling, they'll know immediately that I'm their sibling. There's no real effective way to do that. And so it was, I pushed. I said, you need to tell me, I need to get confidence in some way if I can't see, if I don't have control. And this applies at global scale, right? So this technology is being deployed. It's not everywhere, but where it is being deployed, we are seeing some great things happening. So I don't know if you've heard of the cancer moonshot, but this also relates to genetic data. And the more information you can coalesce, the more insights you can gain, right? Interestingly, genetic data is one of those examples where it's extremely personal, but impossible for me to derive value myself. Right? I actually have to let someone else who understands how to process that data in order to tell me, am I susceptible to this, or how do we react? So how do we resolve that? So the National Cancer Institute is actually looking to use this approach where the drug companies can say, while they're reluctant today, they can say, look, protect your data, wrap it, keep the keys. You'll inherently know exactly when that data is being used because we'll be requesting the keys. You'll know what system is requesting the keys. If you change your mind, if it turns out these are crown jewels that you want back, you can do so because you always hold the keys. Really being able to unlock problems at scale is an opportunity, and it's a fortuitous cycle. With increased transparency, there can be increased trust. That comes with increased collaboration, and that can feed back as you have these collaborations and build more trust. So it's a way to sort of bootstrap that interaction. So we will make it easier to share data at global scale to address global scale problems, I hope. And my hope is that soon we'll all have the reflex, almost like if someone asked you not to put on your seatbelt, that if a company collaborator expects you to give up control, you ask the hard questions. And you seek out the platforms that help us collaborate with confidence, such that your data stays your own. And that if we take this approach, I'm pretty confident that we'll improve our ability to keep the bad actors out, we'll effectively collaborate, and we'll get the most out of what we know in combination with the knowledge and the insight of others. Thank you.
Reading some of these questions, we have a very enlightened and well-informed audience out there. So there, some of them overlap, and I'll try to paraphrase to try to communicate what you're after as best I can. First one, Will, tell us why the Internet of Things is not our nation's Achilles heel, i.e. Twitter, Amazon, Netflix, Spotify, etc.
So there are sort of two different things, right? So you've got the sort of online services like Twitter and Netflix, and then you have and those aren't in and of themselves devices that you have in your home. Internet of Things, your Samsung TV might connect to Netflix, but the Internet of Things actually does have the potential to be very dangerous. It's a lot harder to, when you find a vulnerability in the software that's on your TV or on your Nest thermostat, to update that so it's no longer insecure. But those actually can get turned against us, and we've seen that happening. So we really do have a gap that we need to address in terms of making sure that the devices, as we get billions and billions of wired devices in our home, they're not being used to attack services at will, because it is happening today.
Well, can you discuss some of the bad guys and their capabilities, North Korea, China, Russia, Iran, and are they as proficient as the media would like us to believe?
I think it's varied. I think when it comes to, and I'm not speaking from a lot of experience on some of these, so I'm conjecturing, but when it comes to Russia, I think they're absolutely very sophisticated. I think in some ways that's a good thing. With regards to someone like Iran and North Korea, or nation states that haven't had as much experience, I think they're more unpredictable. The barrier to entry is very low. So the people who I worry about the most are those who are sort of out of the basement kinds of hackers. I don't know if that answers the question.
Well, we got a bunch up.
Yeah.
So can your security approach be used in a blockchain?
That's a great question. We've been looking
why don't you define blockchain for everybody?
Yeah, so the blockchain has been used as a way of trying to decentralize transfer of assets, right? So it's basically a public ledger online where you can assert, it can be anything from some sort of virtual dollar to a painting, right? So the ability to come together with your keys and say, oh, I used to have this painting, I used to own it, but now you can. And in fact, the blockchain can be used with regards to the keys that I was talking about earlier to protect any data asset you have online. So if you want to transfer ownership of, let's say, some drug data, you can use the blockchain to execute that transaction and make sure everyone knows in a public way that it's now yours.
Who do you think accessed John Podesta's emails?
No idea.
I know.
A lot of people.
What are your concerns regarding confidentiality of text messages, and can they be deleted?
Text messaging, as it was originally imagined and implemented, is very hard to delete. But luckily, there are applications. If that's the kind of mode of operation that you like, I would highly recommend Signal. So it is actually a very ephemeral text messaging app, and it feels the same, but it's an upgraded level of security, and the messages can actually go away.
Will there ever be a 100% secure system, especially for our financial system and financial services companies?
Nope. I mean, it's sort of it's an evolution, right? So, TDF is not going to solve the problems. There's always going to be, it's always a cat and mouse game. But hopefully we can stay ahead.
What can we ordinary folks do to prevent getting hacked, and what should we do if we get hacked?
Good question. I think one of the most vulnerable aspects of our identity is our email, right? So if someone gets into your email account, it isn't just the email themselves, but what that identity means, right? So a password reset request for a different account, that kind of thing. So make sure that you are establishing your email identity with an internet, with a provider that is trustworthy. I know the big guys like Microsoft and Google are actually quite good at this, but it's only as good as your password and the credentials that you use to log in. If an adversary gets your password, that's something that can be copied very easily. It can be sniffed. It can get lost. All the major providers today allow you to tie that identity to your phone. So the best single thing you can do is make sure that you have this as a second factor. If you're logging into a different computer, they'll know. They'll send you a text message with a number. You type it in, and it's great.
What do you think we should tell or explain to our children and grandchildren about security? I think this was meant in the realm of social media,
yeah.
Snapchat, Facebook.
It's interesting. I've seen kids growing up learning more about, seeing the fact that what they have posted on Facebook doesn't go away, or it's really hard to. I think it's just going to be educating them and just really realizing that what you put online, you have to assume is going to be there forever. Other than that, I think that's the biggest thing.
Do you recommend there is anything to do to combat malvertising? Does everybody know what malvertising is?
Yeah, so Google is probably... I think we're going to have to rely a lot more on the big guys who can see what's happening at scale to understand what advertising might be trying to direct you to a website to download something that's going to infect your computer. It's very hard for an individual to parse out things like that. So while I'd love to say we can sort of take control ourselves for everything, luckily the folks like Google are putting tremendous work into trying to prevent that. It's not perfect, but there's progress being made. The one thing I would say is if you're ever going to add something to your computer, just make sure it's from a website that's got the green lock in the corner. It means it's an authenticated website. And if you can, try to stick to those websites that you think are trustworthy.
And I'm not sure you can answer this last one, but FBI Director Comey, did he do the right thing?
I don't have a technical answer to that. I'll defer.
Should we... Any more questions from the floor?